Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and joining us today is Dr. Samuel Hyken, a bariatric surgeon at St. Peter's Health Partners Bariatric and Metabolic Care, a nationally accredited center dedicated to helping patients achieve lasting health. He specializes in advanced weight loss procedures, including gastric bypass, sleeve gastrectomy, revisional bariatric surgery, and treatments for reflux. Dr. Hyken received his medical degree from Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, where he also completed a residency in general surgery. He completed a fellowship in minimally invasive and bariatric surgery at the University of Rochester. The number to call if you have a question today about bariatric surgery, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Samuel Hyken, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before we get rolling here with questions and everything else, here's one I've never seen before on a bio, an intro of a doc. We've done a fair number of bariatric surgery shows over the years. I have never seen revisional bariatric surgery. What is that?
Yeah, revisional surgery is something that's kind of growing in popularity. I won't say popularity, but it's something that we're doing a lot more of recently. Bariatric surgery is clearly weight loss surgery. And, a lot of those patients do well. Probably 80% of those patients, closer to 90%, depending on which program you're at,
yeah,
are going to get good, solid weight loss from those procedures. What happens is that sometimes those procedures don't get you to where you want to be. And what revisional surgery is it's changing something that was done originally to try and get those patients the extra weight loss, or if they regain their weight over time. So revisional surgery changes what's been done to try and get those patients that benefit.
Now, wait, you mean you're fixing someone's mistake, or the patient is not behaving properly and following orders?
Could be both. And unfortunately, sometimes it's impossible to know which one of those two things it is. Because when I'm evaluating a patient for a revisional surgery, I can only see a snapshot in time. So I can see what their anatomy is right now.
Yeah.
I can't, there's no way for me to know what it was in the distant past. I can't say, you know, this surgeon didn't do this part right, which is why you regain the weight down the road. Or this is clearly something that you're doing from a behavioral standpoint, diet, exercise, what have you, that's caused that weight regain. All I can say is this is not right. This is what we can do to fix it.
We're joined by Dr. Samuel Hyken, a bariatric surgeon at St. Peter's Health Partners Bariatric and Metabolic Care. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's instructive for me to know the difference between a gastric bypass and a sleeve gastrectomy. And then we'll go back to revisional bariatric surgery, and I'll ask you some follow-ups on that. So explain gastric bypass and then sleeve gastrectomy.
Yeah, so I think that's a good approach because you need to know what normal is in order to know what abnormal is, and then how you can monkey with abnormal in order to make it correct. So basic anatomy lesson, food travels down the esophagus, enters the stomach. Stomach has two functions. One is to store the food. The other is to start processing that food. That processed food gets delivered to the small bowel where it gets absorbed, and that's how digestion works. What a gastric sleeve is it's where we take that stomach and make it significantly smaller. We turn it from, you can think of like a balloon, into something that's more banana shaped. So that restricts how much you're able to eat. So when you do eat that food expands that smaller stomach much more quickly. And that message gets interpreted in your brain as I'm full, so you stop eating sooner.
Right. Okay.
Okay. So that's a sleeve in a nutshell.
Gotcha.
What a bypass does is it takes that to another degree. So what you do there is you start by making a really small stomach. It's about the size of your two thumbs put together. So the same way that the sleeve works, it restricts how much you're able to eat. Very easy to fill something that's only the size of your two thumbs.
Two saltines. I mean, come on.
Done and done.
Real, wait a minute now. Okay. So you talk about revisional bariatric surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And so implicit in that is that oftentimes, people will have these surgeries, and we'll get into the details more of the two different types as we go along, but they'll have these surgeries, and then they'll gain weight again.
Mm-hmm.
Is it dangerous for someone who has the stomach the size of two thumbs to eat enough to gain weight? And then is there danger of the actual stomach ripping apart?
Yeah, so the body is an amazing thing. Let me start by saying that. You can put your body through a whole host of, you know, different ailments, and it's going to adapt to what it is that you're doing. So one of the things that I commonly tell my patients is that, you know, if I said I was going to do this operation on you, and I told you that if you gain weight afterwards, I'd give you $1 million, I promise you every patient that I made that deal with would come in heavier than when they started, because where there's a will, there's a way. And, you know, one of the things that I noticed pre-COVID, I was over at Johnny Rockets, and they had the calorie counts on their menus, and burger, fries, Coke, and one of the shakes on their menus, you're looking at 3,000 calories, 4,000 calories. If you're doing that and then eating on top of that throughout the day, I don't care what surgery you've had, you are going to gain weight.
Yeah.
So once again, where there's a will, there's a way. So the surgery is a good tool to help you get to where you want to be, but it's not the end all and be all. You know, you have to incorporate a diet and a healthy lifestyle in addition to the surgery or to the medications or anything else in order to be effective in your weight loss journey.
Okay. By the way, what were the toppings on the burger?
Over the top. Take your pick.
By the way, this is the issue, right? Mm-hmm. This is the issue with Americans, presumably most people across the world. You want the shortcut. Mm-hmm. We see all the weight loss wonder drugs.
Yes.
We see this surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Are you vetting people psychologically to see if they're going to not do a darn thing?
Oh,
which is what I would do, by the way, if you gave me the surgery.
Yeah, so you would not be a good candidate for the operation.
Right, you
then.
Are.
Yeah, so one of the things that we do and we put a lot of effort in is making sure that we can maximize people's chances of success through our program. So we have you see, you know, myself or my partner, Dr. Joshi, at your first visit, and then we will establish you with a dietitian to help you on the dietary aspect of this. And we also have you see a mental health provider to make sure you're in a good, healthy mental state to be successful after the surgery, because we want to maximize those chances of success. Back in the day, you would not see those other people. You would see the surgeon. They'd say, yep, you look good. We'd whisk you off to the operating room, do the operation, wish you the best of luck, and, you know, good luck. Today, we are doing a whole bunch of preoperative education, mental health counseling, dietary education, and then we see you a lot after the surgery, too, to make sure that you are maximizing your chances of success.
Now, you can't hold everyone's hand 24/7, so you have to hope that something sinks in with the patient. By the way, we're talking bariatric surgery with Dr. Samuel Hyken today. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. If the patient is good enough to follow the instructions, change their lifestyles, do they even need the surgery?
Well, we've looked at that too. So there have been multiple studies that look at that because, you know, what we know about obesity, it's not a willpower issue. That is a common misconception amongst the general public that it's you know, this patient struggles with obesity because it's something that they're doing. We know that's just not the case. What we do know is that with good quality education, dietary regimens, behavioral health modification, and surgery, success rates go up to about 85-90%.
For how long?
4 or 5 years is where those studies are brought out to. So to say that patients can do it on their own without all of those things, success rates are about 2%. So, you know, you see these ads on, you know, the internet, on TV all the time. Oh, do this diet. You're going to lose 100 pounds and look at how great I look. Chances of any of those working is about 2-3%, to get back to your original question.
Now, you're a cutter. I mean, you're not someone who is a counselor after the fact, right? You are there to do the surgery.
I don't like to consider myself a cutter, but I get what you're saying.
You know. So the thing is, after a certain amount of time, that patient is basically in the wilderness, right? After 5 whatever years of follow-up, right? How do we know? I mean, you track up to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
What's 15 years look like?
Yeah. So that's why, you know, the original studies that were done looked at 5-year data. So when I quote you, you know, X percentage of body weight loss with this procedure versus that procedure versus this medication, that's on 5-year data, except the medications, which haven't been out long enough to get that 5-year data.
Wigovi, we're at like 3-year data. And those
We're talking Ozempic, Wegovy's, you know, the GLP-1s
We'll talk about that after the break, too.
Sure. So we're looking at five-year data because that's what all of our main studies were based on. What we do is that we continue to follow you even after those 5 years, because what we know is that if you keep up with the diet, exercise, you know, your behavior surrounding food and eating and all of that, we can continue that weight loss beyond those 5 years. But that's kind of the metric that we use in order to determine what's considered a success. Success being defined as losing half of your excess body weight and keeping that off for those 5 years.
All right, let's take a break here. Dr. Samuel Hyken is our guest. He's a bariatric surgeon at St. Peter's Health Partners Bariatric and Metabolic Care. We'll get to the phones and the email shortly. 800-348-2551 or voxpop at wamc.org. How about a little Basie and such? Hey, you know, tomorrow's Giving Tuesday. We're a nonprofit. Just saying. I mean, maybe tomorrow, a couple of ching ching. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Samuel Hyken is our guest today. All right, quickly, before we get to the phones and the emails and such, let's talk about these GLP-1s. What your opinion is as a doctor, as a cutter, and also, what do you think? Are you concerned over the long term? We haven't seen a lot of long term data about what these things do. And as I understand it, you're basically going to be on it for life.
That is 100% true. So, yeah, I think there's a time and place for everything. I think there's a patient population where the GLP-1s are going to be extraordinarily helpful and should certainly continue to be used and that. What the data are starting to say about specifically my patient population. So I deal with, you know, patients BMI 35 to 40 with a medical comorbidity, an automatic qualifier.
Meaning what? Diabetes,
heart disease? High blood pressure, cholesterol, or sleep apnea are the big four that the insurance companies are concerned about when your BMI is in that 35 to 40 range. Above 40, that's an automatic qualifier for what I do. So there have been a lot of studies that have come out, well, a couple studies, I should say, that have come out recently that have looked at my patient population and being on these GLP-1s. And what the drug companies will quote is a total body weight loss of around 10 to 15%. Pick your favorite GLP-1. It's going to be a little bit different, but it's going to be in that range. And I'm talking total body weight loss here. So NYU just put out a study that was presented at the ASMBS, which is our governing body for bariatric surgery, this year at our annual meeting, that compared patients on GLP-1s versus having surgery. So this is going to be surgical patients who are either on GLP-1 or they have surgery.
Right.
And what they found is in that patient population, total body weight loss at 3 years was approximately 4 to 5% versus surgery, where that same total body weight loss was about 24%.
Okay, so that's a big difference.
That's a huge difference.
Right.
And the big thing there is that when you have all these medical comorbidities because of obesity, you need to lose more weight in order to better manage those medical comorbidities, which is where surgery comes into play.
Well, is that data skewed to some extent? And maybe you set this up and I didn't catch it, by people who are perhaps a tad vain and get this when they really don't need it. They might not be as obese as all that. Their BMI might not be as high as all that, but they're taking it because they have a little bit of vanity.
Yeah, well, and I have no problem with that. I think that's a good use for those medications. If you are starting to gain weight and you need a little bit of a kick to kick, you know, to get yourself in the correct mindset in order to jumpstart your weight loss, I think that's a great use for these medications.
But it's not a jumpstart because you got to be on it forever or you pork out again.
My hope, though, is that once you get the ball rolling, then you can start weaning yourself off these medications, because you're right. That's what we do know about these things. As soon as you come off of them, more often than not, you're going to regain your weight. But if you can use them as a little bit of a crutch to create good habits for yourself, then to me, that's the best case scenario.
Now, these medications, they started as diabetes meds, right?
They are diabetes meds.
So, I mean, I could see that that would be an important thing regardless of your weight. I could see taking that if that's the only thing that's going to work. Now, let's talk. I promise we'll get right back to the phones in a moment. 800-348-2551. I wanted to talk a little bit about reflux. Now, we know about the medications. They've been out there for a long time. And I just wonder, you know, you're a surgeon and you do treatments for reflux. There has to be something that you can do that maybe I don't know about.
Yeah. So the book answer for surgical treatment of reflux in a patient with a BMI of 35 or above is a gastric bypass. So the procedure we were discussing before. So once again, you make that stomach nice and small, size of your two thumbs put together. Very hard to produce a lot of acid when you're only, when your stomach's only, you know, 30 cc, 30 milliliters big.
Yeah.
Then what we do is we reroute the small bowel to connect that stomach to a new loop of bowel so that food travels down one way and all the rest of the digestive juices that are made in your native stomach, not that new stomach that we created for you, are traveling down a completely different path.
Interesting.
And because your acid is going one way and your food is going the other way, the acid never sees the esophagus. So that's 90 to 95% effective in curing your acid reflux.
But does it affect anything else? I mean, you can get Barrett's esophagus because of the issues with the acid.
Yeah.
If it's not going to the esophagus, is it causing some trouble, possibly leading to cancer down the road somewhere else?
Well, yeah, so Barrett's is a huge topic with me. So the sleeve, like we talked about before, can increase your acid reflux by about 33% of the time. So in a patient who has Barrett's, I will not do a sleeve on you for that exact reason because you're increasing the acid exposure to your esophagus. So if you have Barrett's and you're seeing me for bariatric surgery, I will put my foot down and I will say you need to have a bypass. And when I do surveillance follow-ups on those Barrett's patients who I do bypasses on, I can't remember the last time I still saw histologic evidence of Barrett's on those patients because the acid exposure is, you know, near zero. That being said, the recommendation is still to stay on your PPI if you have Barrett's. But that's something interesting anecdotally that I've seen in my Barrett's patients is that histologic evidence goes away.
We're joined by Dr. Samuel Hyken, a bariatric surgeon at St. Peter's Health Partners Bariatric and Metabolic Care. The number is 800-348-2551. All right, you've waited long enough. Let's go to the phones. And if we get a break, I want to talk about the differences in side effects or the of sleeve gastrectomy and the bypass and just how long they've been studied and what are the bad things. But I'll spare you that for a minute and we'll go to the phone.
That's the fun stuff.
Raj in Danville, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my calling. Yes. And my question is a two-part question. Firstly, I've heard that bariatric surgery falls under cosmetic weight loss. So do you insurances cover them in full? If so, what is the criteria?
Yes, Raj, thanks for your question. So to answer the first part, most insurance companies do have a bariatric clause in them, but not all insurances. So one of the things that I strongly recommend that you do before you get involved in a bariatric program is call your insurance company to figure out whether or not your specific plan has coverage because you don't want to get caught with bills that you do not expect.
Okay. My second part of the question is, if somebody is on a program like a GLP-1 or Zepbound or whatever, and then is it okay to do the bariatric also, or what would be the recommendation at what point somebody has to stop?
Okay. Yeah, that is a fantastic question. And that is actually one of the hot topics that's been discussed for the last 2 years at our annual meetings is, you know, what do we do with these patients who are either doing well or not doing well on these GLP-1s if they decide that they're not getting the benefits that they want or they're not seeing the health benefits that they want in terms of resolution of their medical comorbidities if they decide to jump ship and come over to the dark side where I work. And what we're finding is that even some patients who have surgery, so this is what we were getting to before, is that, you know, 10 to 20% of patients who have surgery end up regaining their weight down the road, you know, 5 years out. What do we do for those patients if they don't qualify for revisional surgery? And what we're finding is that obesity functions a lot like cancer in the sense that you need to take a multifaceted approach to treat the disease. So what we've talked about already is diet, exercise, behavioral health. But, you know, even if you've had surgery, some patients still need more treatment in order to respond. And in those cases, a lot of places are using the GLP-1s as an adjuvant treatment, to use a cancer term, to try and help with the weight loss.
Raj, thanks a lot. Great questions. 800-348-2551 is the number. Dr. Samuel Hyken joins us from St. Peter's Health Partners today. Let's go to Western Mass. Beth, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I'd like to put something on the table and hang up.
Okay.
You probably can't address this thoroughly. I get it. Trust me. Mid-80s, I was lucky enough to work in one of maybe three group homes in the country for people with Prader-Willi syndrome. Is there anything on the table combined with what you do, combined rather with neurological assistance that might help these people?
Yes.
I can hang up now.
Beth, thanks a lot. Now, tell us what the syndrome is, first of all.
Yeah, so Prader-Willi is a genetic syndrome that kind of the way it involves me is that these patients have an increased desire to eat. So they tend to suffer from obesity from a dysregulation of their hunger hormones. I know of one patient that I've personally done a gastric bypass on with Prader-Willi who ended up doing fairly well. This was back in fellowship. They ended up losing a good chunk of weight. And then after I graduated from my fellowship, I didn't follow them any further.
Huh.
But we have operated on patients with Prader-Willi to try and re-regulate that hunger hormone response that these patients
get.
Can't
you just do hormone therapy?
I mean, if it was that easy, we wouldn't have jobs.
Okay, fair enough. Number here is 800-348-2551. Very quickly, sleeve gastrectomy and bypass, which came first?
Yeah, so the bypass is kind of the tried and the true. It's
goes
been around
back
the
50 years.
It goes back well before my time.
Okay.
The sleeve actually was born out of a duodenal switch. A duodenal switch, let me start there.
Right.
Is a sleeve with a really big bypass attached to it.
Okay.
And it used to be done in two stages. So what surgeons would do is they would bring you in, they would do the sleeve as I described it to you. They'd send you on your way, bring you back 6 to 8 weeks later,
yeah,
and then do the really big bypass portion of the operation.
Okay. Yep.
What ended up happening was that patients would get their sleeve, they would go home, they would lose a ton of weight, and they would think to themselves, self, why am I going to do the really dangerous part of this operation because I'm losing all of this weight?
Right.
So that's how the sleeve was born in this country. So all these patients out here who are getting sleeves, which is the most common bariatric procedure performed in this country right now, are actually getting stage one of a duodenal switch.
Interesting.
So when we talk about weight regain after a sleeve, there are some places out there that are going back to the sleeve's intended purpose, which is stage one of a duodenal switch, and they're converting those weight regain sleeves to a duodenal switch.
Interesting. Now, you know, we've looked at one type of surgery for a long time, the other one a considerable amount of time. What have we seen, aside from the people who gain weight again, what side effects and what possible dangers are there, mm-hmm, aside from, you know, any mishap in actual surgery? What sort of things could go wrong down the road?
Yeah. Yeah. Luckily, these surgeries are very safe. We have mountains upon mountains of data showing how safe they are in the perioperative period. You're looking at like a 1-2% risk in the perioperative period of anything going wrong, that being, you know, from the most mundane things like infections to the most serious things like blood clots or leaks, things from inside the stomach getting
right
out of the
mm-hmm
stomach. Long-term effects are very good. There are a few things that you have to worry about. With the sleeve, we talked about the reflux is the biggest thing
right
that I worry about. That's
yep
going to be the most common thing that's going to affect somebody's quality of life
mm-hmm
in the long term. You do have to worry a little bit about vitamin mineral deficiencies. So we do check you yearly for that. With the bypass, you have to be much more worried about vitamin and mineral deficiencies because of that rerouting process
right
like we discussed earlier. The other thing that I worry about with a bypass are going to be things like bowel obstructions. Because of that rerouting process, you open up new avenues you can think of for the bowel to travel on, and those can become a problem down the road. Your risk of that is about 3% lifetime.
Oh, that's okay. Still very low.
So it's still very low. The other thing with the bypass that I worry about are ulcers. So things like NSAIDs, ibuprofen, Advil, Aleve, Motrin, Mobic, Naproxen, Aspirin. Steroids can also cause ulcers. Smoking can also cause ulcers. Ulcers being an erosion in the lining of the stomach.
Interesting. The number here is 800-348-2551. You talk about, and we're going to go right to the phone, Betsy and Adams, you're next. You talk about absorbing vitamins, and there couldn't be an issue there, especially with the sleeve, right?
More so with the bypass, because of that malabsorption,
What about absorbing medication, if you're on medication for other things?
So typically we don't have too much of an issue with that. Occasionally we will have to adjust doses, and the interesting part is it's not always adjusting it up. Sometimes we need to adjust it down. Because you have less of you around, if your body is able to better absorb it, you don't need as much to get the same effect. So sometimes that adjustment goes down. And, you know, especially for things like diabetes medications, which we haven't talked about, the beauty of the bypasses is that a lot of my patients right after their surgery are going home on a lower diabetes regimen than they come in on. Some of them are able to get rid of their diabetes medications altogether.
Interesting. All right, the number here is 800-348-2551. Let's grab at least one before the next break. Betsy is in Adams, Massachusetts. Betsy, you're on. Go ahead.
Oh, hello there. Hello, doctor.
Hello.
I had the gastric bypass in 2016. I had a long history of yo-yo dieting and obesity. And so finally, in my 50s, I decided to get the gastric. I lost weight with other methods, but it kept coming back.
Mm-hmm.
So,
happened
after the what?
I was just saying, I hear that all the time. You are a very common patient in my world.
Yeah, I was a fat kid and, you know, blah, 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 in society, da, da, da. Okay. Anyway, I lost over 100 pounds
good
five times in my life, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And all the different methods. So, but when I got the gastric bypass, I did lose the weight, but I ended up with a terrible, terrible alcohol addiction. And I've done some research, and I know that that happens. And it's not it wasn't a transfer thing for me. I got to tell you, some people say it, but there was something that happened in my body that I had to drink. I mean, I drank before, but not like I had no problem. I had a life, I had a career. All of a sudden, I just could not stop drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I could not stop. Like it was this crazy monster inside of me. I mean, I lost the weight, and then, you know, I ended up, now I'm sober, almost 2 years sober, but
congrats.
It took me a long time after a lot of problems. And now I've, you know, and then I gained a lot of weight back during COVID trying to get sober because you eat a lot of candy. And now I've lost 40 pounds. So,
good job.
I'm an exerciser. I was an avid rollerblader. I mean, I do all the things. I was a good patient. I did all the things. So I just wonder if you know anything about that, because I don't want it coming back.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you've said a lot of things that have piqued my interest. First thing that you said is that you were able to lose 100 pounds multiple times prior to bariatric surgery. And there was just a study that I read maybe a month or two ago that came out in one of my journals that talked about how patients who can have a massive success prior to surgery are more likely to succeed after surgery. And they don't know why, but that was one of their findings. So if you've lost 50, 100 pounds in the past, you are more likely to lose a significant amount with bariatric surgery and keep it off. Take that for what it is.
Interesting.
To your alcohol question. Yeah, so we see alcoholism after specifically a bypass. You know, and it's a pretty significant thing. We talk about it at your follow-up appointments, make sure you're aware of the risk of that. And some of it, as you said, could be transference of bad habits, but for a lot of patients, it's not. It's something more chemical than that. So they've looked at this, and what they found is that when you drink alcohol normally, in normal anatomy, that alcohol sits in your stomach and it gets broken down by your digestive juices into a less pure form of alcohol, and that's the form that gets delivered to your small bowel, which then gets absorbed. After a bypass, because your stomach is so small, your stomach doesn't have time to process that alcohol. So you're sending a more pure form of alcohol into your system, which is going to have an increased effect on your body, which makes you more prone to want that effect in the future. So some of that could certainly be at play.
That was at play for sure. I tried not to drink after. I was a good patient, and I lost the weight, and I went to the gym and all that stuff. And, you know, and then all of a sudden it was like I had to drink. That's the part I don't understand. It was like a monster inside of me that, like, I don't feel like it was a transfer. So I don't know if you know anything about that. I mean,
yeah, well, I think that's going to be part of that addictive nature of alcohol in general. So because it's a purer form, you have a stronger desire from the addiction mindset in order to want that feeling more than before when you had normal anatomy and you were getting that less pure form.
Betsy, I got to take a break here, but that was a very interesting call. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Dr. Samuel Hyken today, a bariatric surgeon at St. Pete's. We'll be back. Wes Montgomery and Milt Jackson there, Stairway to the Stars here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. Yes, indeed, it's bariatric surgery today with Dr. Samuel Hyken. Having fun so far?
Absolutely.
Splendid.
This has been great.
Let's do a couple emails and try to keep it rolling then. These are about drugs. Susan in Clifton Park asks, what's your opinion on whether long-term PPI use can increase the risk of Alzheimer's to dementia?
Yeah, so there was a study that came out, I want to say a year or two ago, that certainly showed that. So that's one of the reasons why I really advocate for gastric bypasses in my patients in particular. Is the hope is to be able to get rid of those PPIs. And, you know, I always have this discussion with my gastroenterology colleagues in these gastric bypass patients who do have Barrett's, which is why we do the bypass.
Right.
Without the histologic evidence, why can't these patients come off of their PPIs to lower that Alzheimer's risk?
Yeah.
And they just won't jump the, you know, they won't make that leap of faith and say, yep, no Barrett's, you can get off of them. I keep hoping each and every day.
All right. This one's about the GLP-1 side effects, and this is from I don't know who. What are your thoughts on the incidence and severity of side effects from taking GLP-2 medications? Is there such a thing as GLP-2? I assume it's a typo.
GLP-1, yeah.
My gastroenterologist, a member of one of the largest groups in the region, advised that 50% of his patients are those seeking help with managing side effects of GLP-1.
Oh,
is that true?
I don't know the exact numbers. As the surgeon, I don't deal a lot with the GLP-1s, but I can tell you what I know from the periphery. I do know that a lot of the reason why the real-world use of GLP-1s doesn't match up to the drug company representation of the weight loss, and it's because of those side effects. So the most common side effects are going to be GI-type things, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, you know, because the drugs work by slowing down your GI tract. That's how they create that satiety feeling, that feeling of fullness. Some of the more serious side effects that I hear about are things like things that affect the gallbladder, so development of gallstones and cholecystitis. You can develop pancreatitis from these types of drugs, but those are going to be much rarer side effects. Typically, it's going to be these GI upset things that lead to intolerance and people stopping the drugs.
Number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Samuel Hyken is our guest today. It's bariatric surgery, and let's go to Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
Are they finding more and more side effects due to the weight loss drugs?
Are they finding more?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's the thing about any new drug that comes out is that when it first gets released, it's you know, it's certainly tested on a group of individuals so they can get a general side effect profile. But once you start releasing this to the masses, then new certain side effects certainly come up. And over time, I'm sure we're going to hear about new side effects that are coming out with these medications, just like with any other medication.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot for the call. It's 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Amy's in Albany. Hello, Amy.
Hello.
You're on.
Hello.
Hi, you're on.
Hi. I am a patient of Dr. Hyken's.
Oh, boy.
I had bariatric surgery back in 2021. I had a gastric sleeve. In which I was almost 300 pounds at my top of my weight. I was able to bring it down to about 70 pounds from that point on, and then waffled back and forth. And just about a year ago, one of the doctors that works with Dr. Hyken, Dr. Patharada, recommended me to go on Wegovy, and I had great success with that. I finally ended up bringing myself finally over under 200 pounds, and I'm at a very happy weight now of 150 pounds. And such. My question is, now that I've been able to reach my goal weight, what is the prospects of weaning myself off of things like Wegovy, and what is going to be for the future?
Yeah. Hi, Amy. Nice to chat with you again. Yeah, so this is what we were talking about before, is that there is a certain subset of patients who need everything thrown at them in order to maximize benefit. So there are a certain portion of patients who just with surgery, diet, and exercise don't get to where they want to be, just like there are certain patients with diet, exercise, and the GLP-1s who don't get to where they need to be. This is that cancer approach that we were talking about. So there are some patients who need everything that we've got: diet, exercise, behavioral health modification, surgery, and GLP-1s, which it sounds like you fall under that category and have found great success. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of good data out there right now on what we do with patients who are in your shoes in terms of weaning off of these GLP-1s. In my perfect world, we would use these as a crutch to get you to where you want to be, and we'd be able to wean them down, and you'd be able to carry yourself the rest of the way. Unfortunately, we don't have any good data to support doing that right now, so it's going to be a little bit of a guess and check. My guess is that Dr. Pat will try and wean you down a little bit, see what you do, and hopefully eventually we can get you off of these things to minimize the side effects of long-term use. But like I said, there's no good data on this specific patient population right now, to my knowledge.
Amy, thanks for the call. All right, this is a recurring refrain. There's not enough data. Mm-hmm. In your estimation, and only in your opinion, Dr. Hyken, has enough time in this case of the GLP-1s been given to look at the long-term side effects? In other words, it went into play pretty quickly, and it's shown a lot of promise, and side effects have been rather minimum on the short term. But are you uncomfortable at all with the speed of the rollout?
No, not at all. I think within the right patient population, these things are changing lives, which is always a good thing. It's giving people access to healthcare that they didn't have before. And in my opinion, that's always a good thing. What's the tough question for me is, what is the right population, and when is when do I need to be involved from a surgical standpoint, especially in patients who qualify for surgery? Because what we're seeing is that and they've looked at this. This was another study that was just rolled out at our most recent ASMBS, is looking at specifically cardiovascular disease. And what they found is that in patients who qualify for surgery, it would take 60 patients on a GLP-1 in order to save one heart attack, essentially. In that same population, you would need to treat 10 to 12 patients with surgery to prevent that same one heart attack.
So about five times better.
Five times better, correct.
Amazing. All right, our guest is Dr. Samuel Hyken. It's 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Talk about BMI just for a minute here.
Sure.
Before I go to the next email. You know, it's not a subjective thing, but we see football players who are all muscle who have BMIs that are off the charts.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it still a standard?
Well, it's what the medical society has used for so many years as a way to put people into categories. It's the same thing with other terms like ideal body weight. You know, if you were supposed to be your ideal body weight, then, you know, we'd all be walking around at 112 pounds. It's a made up number that insurance companies use in order to.
It's an actuarial thing.
Correct. It's just used to put people into categories so that we can determine whether or not they meet certain qualifications for this treatment or that treatment, or your insurance premiums are going to be this or that because of this arbitrary number. I mean, it's the same thing with percent excess body weight loss, which is what we use in bariatric surgery to determine the success. It really doesn't mean anything to the individual, but it's a way that we can all communicate with each other as medical professionals to have discussions about how we can help patients better.
When you do your treatment, aside from the insurance, does it play? Does the BMI play?
So there, in my mind, it does to some degree, because the two procedures have a different expectation in terms of the percent body weight loss. And in my opinion, the higher your BMI is, the more weight we're going to want you to lose in order to try and get rid of those medical comorbidities. Mm-hmm. So I use BMI as kind of a soft metric to determine in my mind which procedure I think is going to be better for you. Higher BMI, I think a bypass is going to be a better operation because you're going to lose 10 to 15% more weight with a bypass than you would a sleeve.
All right. Liz writes in, and by the way, the number here, if you want to squeeze in at the end of the show, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Samuel Hyken joins us. Dr. Hyken is a bariatric surgeon at St. Peter's Health Partners, Bariatric and Metabolic Care. Liz writes in. The subject heading is food getting stuck in esophagus. Is there surgery for this? I'm about 50 pounds overweight.
So if there's food getting stuck in the esophagus, there could be a number of things that could be causing that. One could be a functional thing. The other could be an anatomic issue. So an anatomic issue would be like a stricture, a narrowing in the esophagus that's not allowing food to get through that area, which is giving you that stuck sensation. In that case, typically you can have a gastroenterologist do an endoscopy on you, camera down the mouth to take a look at that area. And a lot of times they can dilate that area to try and create enough space so that food will pass more easily. The other thing is that the esophagus might not be functioning properly. You could have esophageal dysmotility is the term for it. And, typically esophagus contracts and propels the food down towards the stomach. If those contractions are not ideal and they are doing so in a kind of a spasmodic way, then the food can't go down into the stomach like it's supposed to, and it can mimic that feeling of getting stuck.
Yeah.
In that case, there are certain medications out there that can try and help your esophagus contract normally to propel the food to get rid of that, what I call dysphagia.
Dr. Samuel Hyken's our guest today. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. In the very old days of this surgery, and you said the bypass was first, right? It was open? I mean, are you doing everything endoscopically now?
So I do everything laparoscopically, which is a little bit different than endoscopic. So endoscopic meaning through the mouth and, into the stomach that way. I do some of my revisional surgery endoscopically.
Okay.
But the majority of the surgery that I do is laparoscopically, which is small incisions. Biggest one in my operation is going to be a little bit less than an inch. Sleeve takes me 3 to 4 incisions. Bypass takes me 4 or 5 incisions. But back when I was a resident, I was right at the cusp of the open versus the laparoscopic world. So we had 2 laparoscopic surgeons and 1 open surgeon. And let me tell you, if bariatric surgery didn't switch over to laparoscopic surgery, it would not exist today, because those open operations were miserable.
Really? From a standpoint of the patient or the doctor?
Both.
Really?
I want no part of that.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so what was so bad about it?
So the incisions were massive. To begin with. And to get a wound like that to close, especially an obese patient who has, chronic inflammation from their obesity, I mean, they got infected all the time. They would open up all the time. There was probably a 50% chance that you would develop an incisional hernia at that open incision. The weight loss was all well and good, but the side effects and the long-term effects of that open operation were just atrocious comparative to the laparoscopic surgery, where we were talking, a 2 to 3% lifetime risk of anything bad happening.
Okay, man. Now, I'm not a surgeon. I would never, ever in a billion years do this. But when you have open surgery, you can sort of see what you're doing.
Yeah.
Laparoscopic. What are you going by, feel? How are you doing that?
Well, so it's interesting that you say feel, because there's now a new version of laparoscopic surgery, which is robotic surgery. And the reason why I prefer laparoscopic surgery is because I can feel the tissue. So I've got the tissue in my hands and I can feel the tension that I'm creating. And the, you know, the really good robotic surgeons will say, oh, I can see the tension. That's not me. I like to have things in my hand and I like to feel it. So I know how hard I can pull on this, that, or the other thing to get the view that I need to be able to do the surgery.
Amazing. Okay, I've never heard that insight before. Let's go to Saratoga. Ethan, you're on.
Yes, hello. My name's Ethan. Thank you for taking my call. I was just curious about, I'm thinking about pulling the trigger on seeing a nutritionist. I've gained a few pounds after having a few kids. I generally know what I should be doing, you know, doing calories in, calories out. And I just wondered, would it be useful to see a nutritionist? And if so, what that might look like?
Hi, Ethan. Thanks for the call. Yeah, 100% I would get on board with that. Reason being is that a lot of people have a general idea of what they need to do, but sometimes seeing a nutritionist provides you with that accountability that you need in order to be successful. So one of the things that we do on the surgery side of things is that we have people attend support groups after their surgery.
Do they have to?
They have to do one before surgery so that they know what resources we have available.
Or what happens?
We won't do the operation. So that is one of the criteria to get the operation. Like we said before, we're trying to maximize success. And what we find is that patients who go to them afterwards lose about 10 to 15% more weight than our patients who are not going to
them.
So same thing with the nutritionist. If you know that you are going to see the nutritionist in 3 weeks, let's say, you are more likely to do the things that you know you're supposed to do for those 3 to 4 weeks leading up to that appointment than had you not had that same accountability. So for the very sake of that, I think it's very important to put yourself on some sort of schedule where you have somebody checking in on what you are going to be doing to hold yourself accountable.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks a lot for the call. All right, doctor, you have exactly 58 seconds. What did we not touch upon today?
Oh, man. So we've hit a lot of the high points. And I think the key gets back to, you know, if you're at a point in your life where obesity is a struggle for you and you're starting to see certain medical comorbidities creeping up in your life, your blood pressure is becoming more difficult to manage. You're now a pre-diabetic. Maybe you don't sleep well at night. Somebody says that you snore. You know, obesity is a metabolic disease. It affects the entire person. If you're starting to see these things creeping into your life, you do not want to go down that road because the wheels start falling off the wagon really quick. Get help. See what we can offer you to try and get your life back in order.
All right. Well done and well said. And thank you for being on the show, Dr. Samuel Hyken. Support comes from Daughters of Sarah, Albany, New York, providing a continuum of care for seniors, offering them opportunities to live at age gracefully with dignity and respect. daughtersofsarah.org. Well, sorry if we didn't get to your question today. We will do this topic again. Thanks to Dr. Samuel Hyken of St. Peter's Health Partners Bariatric and Metabolic Care for being here. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Bob Rathman screened the calls, looking very fit. You're not a candidate for the surgery. Should just mellow out. Tomorrow on the program, it's birding with Rich Guthrie. Julie Hart taking the day off, which is fair because I don't pay her. So she can take whatever time she needs. We'll see you tomorrow at 2 for Birds.